لا 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 لا
in Arabic.
Go go go. Like, yeah, okay. Yeah, cool, cool.
طيب انا احاول احكي محاضري في عربي ان شاء الله. اكو ناس عربيين هم يجون هون ويسمعوا علي. انا كنت عايش في بصرة وبغداد. تحكي عربي؟ طيب okay, I'll do it in English. I'm going to do this in Arabic, but I'm going to do it in English because there's not any Arabic speakers here. Exactly, exactly. Okay, I lived in Basra and Baghdad, occupied Iraq, for the past 9 months. I got back 3 months ago, and part of my work was to support different struggles and different groups in their fight for their own dignity, justice, human rights, and against the occupation. As a British activist, Polish-British activist, it was very difficult to be in Iraq. Myself and Guiba Butterly were both in Iraq, and we came under a lot of harassment from occupation troops and also people who found it hard to believe that foreigners would make the sacrifice to come into an occupied country where people have been so ground down and so suspicious of foreigners and do work. I was supporting, amongst other groups, the Union of the Unemployed. Currently in Iraq, there's 70% unemployment. 70% unemployment and no unemployment benefit. Iraq has the second largest oil reserves in the world. It has the capital, it has the resources to make sure that everybody in Iraq has a good life. The occupation has set the wages for all public sector workers in Iraq. Technically, all the civil service are employees of the United States of America. The lowest wage, slave wage, is 69,000 Iraqi dinar. This is about $45 per month. That's less than half the recommended wages of a sweatshop worker in the neighboring free trade zone in Iran. Now, living standards in Iraq, okay, 69,000 Iraqi dinar. And this is if you have a job, you know, 10 million people do not have jobs. 69,000 Iraqi dinar. Rent is about 50,000 Iraqi dinar. A lot of refugees from Iran have come back. A lot of refugees living in the countryside where life is just, you know, substandard, have come into the cities in search of work. Gas, cooking gas. Last June, a canister of cooking gas was 500 Iraqi dinar. By August, it had rocketed to 12,000 Iraqi dinar. In Basra, this set off riots, and ordinary people, led actually by the Union of Transport Workers, had a massive demonstration and had fisticuffs, punch-ups with British troops. And their demands were, A, lower the price of gas, because this is what people need to cook their food, they need it to heat up their water, it's a staple living requirement. They wanted the end of the theft of petrol, not only from the occupation, but also from unscrupulous Tikriti clan, Ba'athist clans that have traditionally stolen oil and smuggled it around. And three, sacking all Ba'athist bosses. This is really important, a really important fact. There has been no regime change in Iraq. The Ba'athists still hold the power. They still own the means of production. They still own the means of organization because they traditionally had the confidence and the luxury to organize, because ordinary people were not part of the Ba'ath Party, had no chance of that. They're still the managerial class. In the oil sector, which is where I was working with trade unionists, with workers, they still have the same Ba'athist managers. When the regime fell, they actually killed a lot of their Ba'athist managers who had been informing on comrades, getting people killed. They threw them physically out as well, those that were not killed. But the occupation and the Ministry of Oil brought these people back, and they're basically repressing workers using the same means and the same methods as before. Also, in terms of government, Iyad Al-Awi, this is the Prime Minister of Iraq now. He is a former intelligence agent, former intelligence head of operations for the youth sector, which means this man was personally responsible for the torture and killing of many students, young people opposed to the Ba'ath regime. This man is now the Prime Minister. His counterpart, who is an ambassador, but actually a shadow Prime Minister, is John Negroponte. John Negroponte was an ambassador to Honduras. During his term, he was an active proponent, supporter, responsible for the training of a lot of Contras in Nicaragua, Honduras, South American belt. 40,000 plus people were killed in many counterinsurgency operations. This man is now counterpart to Iyad Al-Awi in Iraq. These people mean business. Their job is to repress the Intifada, which is taking place now in Iraq. And a word on the Intifada, the way it's being represented in the press is that it's all Mehdi army, Shia, Islamic fundamentalists, lunatics. This is not the case. The Intifada is widely supported, widespread, and it's is an expression of people's frustration, desperation, and is not limited to religious forces. It comprises many different organizations, many different groups. There's over 53 resistance groups in Iraq, and most of them are sort of religious nationalists, but there's also many people who form their own militias. Iraq is incredibly well armed. There's a mass proliferation of weapons in Iraq. During the Iran-Iraq War from 1980 to 88, the military-industrial complex in Iraq went into overdrive. As a result, you've got bazookas, Stinger missiles, rocket-propelled grenade launchers, Kalashnikovs, all kinds of weapons fully available to everybody. You can buy a hand grenade for $1 in the Babasharchi market in Baghdad. The occupation was giving out leaflets in August with pictures of these weapons, offering, you know, asking people to have an amnesty on their weapons and offering $500, $250 for a Stinger missile, for a bazooka, respectively. People didn't give their weapons up. They wouldn't give up their means of liberation to the occupation. One of the reasons for the Fallujah massacre, the use of a lot of aerial power by the occupation forces in Fallujah, and this was a three-week assault, the three-week massacre. You know, Fallujah had the Jenin treatment. It was surrounded and pummeled, mostly from the air. And one of the reasons for this is because Humvees and Bradley tanks, which the American forces use, are not resistant to RPG fire or bazooka fire. So if they go in, they're going to get absolutely mashed up. And this is one of the reasons why they've only managed to take 10% of Fallujah. You know, actually, American occupation troops were pushed out of Fallujah as far back as June, and they only managed to retake 10%. And the death toll from the Fallujah massacre of April is actually 1,500 people. It's not the 800 or the 1,000 that you see bandied about, because not everybody was buried in those two very infamous soccer fields in Fallujah. A lot of people were buried in their back gardens, and a lot of people didn't go to hospital because the Americans occupied the hospital. And anyway, there was no blood or drip bags or any of the essential medical equipment that was needed in that hospital anyway. So basically, a very important struggle, a very important strike that happened against the occupation, apart from all the military activity that goes on in Iraq right now, was a social struggle of the Southern Oil Company trade union, the Southern Oil Company workers. The SOC is Iraq's biggest and most important oil company. It is the backbone of the Iraqi economy. The northern fields of Kirkuk have been paralyzed. They've been paralyzed for 6 months plus. There's been over 2,500 bomb attacks on the pipelines there, so they're not exporting. Southern Oil Company has just stopped exporting, actually, because the resistance attacks have moved down south there now. But prior to this, workers, they performed a few acts of very serious social resistance. One of them was throwing out all foreign workers and Kellogg Brown and Root employees from their locations. KBR is a subsidiary of Halliburton. Halliburton was formerly headed by Dick Cheney, Vice President of America. Halliburton is a massive corporation, and it's won contracts historically in Iraq as a result of wars and absolute destruction of the infrastructure there to repair oil infrastructure. But this also includes exports, and this is what their contract, which was handed straight out of the Pentagon into their hands, this is what their contract was for: reconstructing the oil sector. And they employed KBR, the subsidiary, to do this. KBR made the cages in Guantanamo Bay. KBR is very tight with the Bush regime. And what the SOC workers did was they threw out KBR from their locations. They said, fuck off, you're not coming in. We're going to do our own reconstruction. We've been doing it for 13 years during the genocidal sanctions regime, when really workers, you know, became inventive geniuses in actually keeping the industry going, using spare parts from the spare market, from the black market, from the ordinary market. And this is what they did again. They did accept some materials from KBR eventually, but on the whole, they did an amazing job of just reconstructing their own work sector. One of the reasons for this was, if they were to go on strike, and a strike against the occupation, they didn't want any stooges of the occupation seeing how their oil industry worked. Second really cool thing they did was they refused Bremer's wage table. The occupation has passed over 70 orders. These are de facto laws. One of them is order number 30 on wages, salary, and employment conditions. And this sets the wages for all public sector workers in Iraq. It has a 13-level wage scale. And the lowest wage, as I said before, 69,000 Iraqi dinars, slave wage. You can't live on it. So what the SOC workers did is they constructed their own wage table in relation to market prices, fluctuating rent prices, fuel prices, food prices, which have all gone up. and also demanded that risk payments and location payments be returned, because people working in the oil sector sometimes have to, you know, stay for 2 weeks in some far-flung desert location, so they don't see their families, they can't go to any shops or anything, so they should get paid more. It's different than office work. So they made their own wage table, and they said Iraqi workers should get 155,000 Iraqi dinar per month, not this derisory 69,000 ID. And if this is not accepted, they said, we will go on strike, we will shut down Iraq from north to south. And it's not an empty threat, because they are really keeping the whole country going. It's the only company that's having a steady flow of oil production. And then they said, if any troops are called in to take over the pumps, and this would happen, because actually Erinis, this is a South African company, the people who work for Erinis are mercenaries, they've also been involved in attacks and murdering and lynching of black South Africans. Erinis, this company, has been employed to guard the whole of the oil sector, and actually they're re-employing former Mukhabarat intelligence agents, high-ranking military Ba'athist officers, and these people were the same people who were repressing Iraqi workers before, and they've been re-employed to do the same job. So there's a high possibility, if they did go on strike, these people would be called in. So they said, if anyone, any military is called in to take over the pumps, we will join the armed resistance and we will fight you. And this is not an empty threat, because the people involved in the SOC union leadership, they fought in the 1991 Intifada against the Ba'athists. They are currently also active in fighting the resurgence of neo-Ba'athism as well. So they meant business. So this obviously sent, you know, terror to the Ministry of Oil, because they were facing the prospect of an armed oil strike. So they relented, and the SOC won their struggle. They won a negotiated rate of 102,000 Iraqi dinar per month and location payments. So this was a big victory. And, you know, that along with the autonomous reconstruction, you know, it's a real slap in the face to the occupation, especially the autonomous reconstruction, because it's a way of showing, it's a way of disrupting the myth of the West knows best, and it's these big corporations like Halliburton and Bechtel that are coming to save Iraq and reconstruct Iraq, when of course it's working class people who will be doing all of that work, and who did the work in the first place. They're the people who built the oil sector, the people who actually keep the oil sector going, and will do so. Another example of some of the problems Iraqi workers are facing is Hartha electricity plant. This is in Basra, and Hartha runs at 25% capacity. It's supposed to provide electricity for the whole of the south. It can't do it because it got destroyed in this war and the war before. The fact that it's running at all is testament to workers' ingenuity, basically cannibalized spare parts from other generators to make this one generator work. Now, Hartha was built by Mitsubishi, massive Japanese giant, and they are not coming back into Iraq for 2 years because of the security threats. So they own the drawings, the plans, the maps, and all the spare parts. So yeah, I went to Hartha, and the workers are sitting there saying, you know, we can repair this place. We can do it. We just need the means to do it. We just need the equipment. So really, Iraqi workers are being deprived of the means of reconstruction. You know, Iraq could be up on its feet if it wasn't for this free market capitalist imperative to fulfill these contracts and have, you know, the power taken out of ordinary people's hands and placed in the hands of these big corporations. So that's really important to mention, that, you know, people, Iraqi workers have got the skills and they've got, you know, the need and the desire to reconstruct their own country. So also women in Iraq having a very, very hard time. They were having a hard time under the regime. Saddam Hussein legalized honor killings. He had a campaign of faithfulness in the late 90s, which in conjunction and collaboration with the Union of Iraqi Women, and this was a Ba'athist union, you know, these women were not putting their gender solidarity first, they were putting their fascistic party agenda first and their party passion first. And they handed over lists of women who were suspected prostitutes to the regime. But a lot of these women were just actually resistant and fighting against the Ba'ath regime. These women were then strung up from trees or beheaded in the street, and their bodies were left as examples of what happens if you fight against the regime. This legacy continues. Honor killing is still prevalent. There is institutionalized misogyny in Iraq at the moment. Girls, young girls who've been raped or sexually assaulted, and these incidences have rocketed since the fall of the regime. If they go to the cop shop, they can't, you know, even if they have the confidence to go there, there isn't any sexual crime to the aid of an officer. All the people there are men. They might not be believed. There's stories of young girls being turned away from hospitals for medical treatment. You know, women are incredibly disrespected in this institutionalized way. And there's an organization that's fighting against this, and they're called the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, which is an Iraqi organization set up in May of last year. And they provide safe houses for women fleeing honor killings and fleeing the prostitution industry. And this is really good work because women really need this kind of support in Iran. The other thing they're doing is they're fighting against the growth of political Islam, which has having a very corrosive effect on gender relations, gender possibilities. In January of this year, the governing council, which is widely reviled, ridiculed, despised, these people cannot go anywhere in Iraq without mass armed escort. I remember when the Baghdad hotel was bombed and one of the governing council members got some shrapnel in his hand or something, and as a result they were all withdrawn to Jordan. You know, these people are dead men, and I think there's two women there now walking. They are dead people. And so anyway, the governing council tried to pass Sharia law in Iraq, which through resolution 137, and what this would mean is stoning to death of women, girls as young as 9 being married off, which the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq sees as basically legalized paedophilia, that women would lose their sort of civil rights in terms of property ownership and inheritance rights as well. So in the end, this was not passed, but the governing council did try and pass this. The problem with the governing council, not only is it totally unelected and unrepresentative, but it's full of crooks. And it also, the Islamic parties involved in this governing council have their own militias, and these are completely unaccountable militias. A lot of them are carrying out a lot of attacks and really, you know, forming a sort of new apparatus of control over Iraqi people. The Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution, they've engaged in lots of protection agreements to protect Ba'athist bosses in Basra. You know, they have this brigade called the Badr Brigades, which makes them very, very powerful. They're also getting a lot of the contracts for reconstruction and passing that through their own networks and their own friends. So again, the people who are poor, working class people in Iraq, stay down and they stay immiserated. And you know, it's really hard because the structures of injustice that the Ba'ath regime built up, with Ba'athist managers handing out some training possibilities and training program opportunities to their own, not to ordinary people. These structures have persisted and they're getting worse. The occupation has rehired over 10,000 Iraqi intelligence agents to help them in their repressive measures. So to sum up, because I could be here all day, the situation in Iraq is incredibly fraught, it's incredibly difficult. The country is still at an infrastructural ground zero that the 13 years of genocidal sanctions ground it into. And make no mistake, those sanctions weren't just aimed at putting pressure on Saddam Hussein. He felt none of that pressure. He kept building mosques and palaces and monuments to himself. They were also geared to actually, grinding the whole country down into an infrastructural ground zero. So for this particular point in time, a free market takeover is possible. A free market takeover is lucrative. And you can hear George Bush already talking about the Middle East Free Trade Agreement. They've already had a lot of success in Jordan. Jordan is the model for Iraq in terms of the free market. Jordan is the only Middle Eastern state that is part of the World Trade Organization. They've got bilateral trade agreements with Israel and America. It's a protectorate for Israeli politicians, American politicians to come and hold their conferences. And it also contains 13 qualified industrial zones, which are free trade zones. And a lot of these are obviously made up of Palestinian slave wage workers and a lot of Filipino women as well. It's a lot of women workers because traditionally in this kind of sector, in this kind of exploitation zone, it's women workers that are required because male workers can fight back. They tend to fight back. They tend to organize better. Women workers can be sexually harassed and humiliated and actually repressed much easier. So Jordan is the model for Iraq. Second thing, the occupation has passed over 70 orders, de facto laws, mostly about economic privatization, none of them about the security of women or the security of children or the vulnerable people in Iraq. And when you take in conjunction order number 30, which institutes slave wages, 69,000 Iraqi dinar minimum wage, many people getting this, this is like $45 a month, less than half the wages of a sweatshop worker in a free trade zone in Iran. When you take this wage order in conjunction with order number 39, which I forgot to mention, this is the goal of the war and occupation in writing. Order number 39 allows for 100% foreign privatization of everything above ground level in Iraq. The oil itself stays Iraqi, but its secondary processing, its refining, its export, its transportation, its marketing, this can all be privatized. Property can be owned for up to 40 years, so you get around, you circumvent that, foreign corporations owning Iraqi land and owning Iraqi property, but 40 years is well enough time for exploitation and profiteering. Also, the highest rate of income tax has been slashed from 45% to 15%. And actually, in the new taxation order from your occupation, it actually exempts, I think, every corporation from tax, because it says that the subsidiaries and subcontractors of international organizations are free from tax. And an international organization is defined as the World Bank, the UN, and I would think as well the United States Agency for International Development, which has been responsible for giving out contracts to Halliburton, to Stevedoring Services of America, to Blackbeach, and all these sort of mercenary companies. So they're actually free from tax. So the other thing about Order 39, it allows for 100% capital flight. So big corporations like Halliburton and Bechtel come into Iraq, make a fortune, make a killing, millions and millions of dollars. They can take that money straight out. None of it has to go into the Iraqi economy or to Iraqi banks or anything. So when you see Order number 30 and Order number 39 taken together, you have actually the transformation of Iraq into one big free trade zone. Dirt cheap wages, massive high profit returns, no tax. This has been the goal of the occupation. So you've got these orders that are repressing people. Third thing, re-Baathification, re-absorption of so many Baathist intelligence agents, police, the managerial class, you know, because the occupation was business as usual. It's not interested in any sort of liberation or, you know, skill sharing and training programs for people who've been structurally repressed and had no privileges, even though they're very talented and very educated. No. You know, it's about having an apparatus which represses people and keeps people really in fear, which people are obviously not going to be because they've had enough of it. And Iraqi people are very, very attuned to manipulation, political repression, all the different sort of machinations that the Baathist regime, you know, exploited. The Baath regime really did exploit every single possible ethnic, religious, and class division possible in Iraq. They did that. It was like an internal empire. And this is what they're attempting to do again with John Negroponte, acting president of Iraq, and this Iyad al-Awi, prime minister of Iraq. There will be 14 permanent military bases in Iraq, American military bases. Part of this is because Saudi Arabia is becoming untenable for an American presence. When you hear in the news about foreign workers' compounds being attacked, this ain't like Filipino workers' compounds in Saudi Arabia. These are mercenaries, oil company executives. You know, Vinelli Corporation was the target of an attack 2 years ago. Vinelli Corporation trades the Saudi Guard. This is like the Special Republican Guard in Iraq. These are incredibly repressive, really monstrous people. Vinelli Corporation also provides security for Paul Bremer and will be providing security for John Negroponte and other occupation scumbags. So, you know, Saudi Arabia is a hot spot now. American military bases have been getting attacked there for years and years. You know, America is facing a crisis, and they're hoping that Iraq will be their next big capital refueling, literally, their capital reboot and their sort of military foothold in the Middle East. They're going to fail. They're facing massive opposition. That their re-Baathification strategy has actually fueled the Intifada, because people are realizing that, you know, even people who at first were saying, yeah, you know, we're happy. I've met people in Basra who are really grateful for the occupation. I've been talking to them on the phone now. They're saying, no, we want them out. We really want them out, because they're realizing that the same nightmare, the same trauma that they were experiencing for so long has been compounded and recycled and relived for them now. So what we have to be aware of is that there will probably be a lot of mass repression, a big wave of repression post June the 30th, executed by governing council, stooges, and American military forces, Polish and British military forces. How many people here, by the way, knew that Poland controls a third of Iraq? Poland. Poland controls one third of Iraq. Poland has the third largest amount of troops after Britain in Iraq. Poland controls five governorates in Iraq. Yani, Poland also has been instrumental in bringing on these privatization, free market shock therapy strategies to Iraq. Marek Belka was a former finance minister of Poland, and he was a special advisor to Paul Bremer in the occupation of Iraq for 1 year, and he's now prime minister of Poland. I'm Polish, so it's a sensitive thing for me. And so anyway, there is going to be mass repression in Iraq post June 30th. What we can do from here to try and respond to that is, you know, I live in England, so we're going to be keeping an eye on the military bases. If there is a re-escalation of warfare, I mean, don't forget, America killed 3 million people in Vietnam. This is much more important to them now, historically, at this point in time. Iraq is much more important to them. So they could unleash horrific assaults. You know, Fallujah, which got the Jenin treatment, similar to Najaf, again, Jenin treatment, surrounding, massacring, indiscriminate use of force, very Israeli occupation force tactics as well, occupying homes, destroying graveyards, desecrating graveyards, this kind of thing. We have to respond to this. One of the ways is, you know, getting into military bases, if they are being reused, if we can see planes taking off, that most likely heading for Iran, disarm those planes. There's nothing illegal about taking a hammer and smashing up an F-16 or a B-52 or a Hawk jet. No way. These are weapons of mass destruction, weapons of massacre, means of massacre. We have the responsibility and, you know, every right behind us, every truth on our side to do that kind of action. And there are people in this country who've done beautiful action like that in Shannon. In fact, you have Shannon Airport. You should all get up to Shannon Airport and give it stuff. So there's that one thing that we've done.
Do you think there'll be a reemergence of Greenham Common again with this?
Inshallah. Hopefully. Second thing is, there are corporate events that are taking place now in London. I don't know about Ireland, but in London there was the Iraq Procurement Conference, which took place in April. This was basically sponsored by Esso, Chevron, Shell, Erinis, the evil South African company that's providing mercenary security for the whole oil sector. These companies had this event, and representatives of the occupation, of the governing council, all turned up to talk about contracts, to talk about signing deals and privatising Iraq. Myself and my friend, we went into this conference and we had a banner and we shouted at the delegates in Arabic, "You, blood on your hands, the blood of the martyrs of Fallujah on your hands, you scum, collaborators, gather, gather, gather." And anyway, we were arrested for aggravated trespass, and the wording of this charge means that we disrupted a lawful meeting, and our argument, which will be in court on the 9th of July, is this meeting was an unlawful meeting. This meeting was illegal. The people who were attending this meeting, organising this meeting, were committing criminal acts, because it's a constituent part of the process of pillage, which is illegal under the Hague Regulations, 1907. Britain is a signatory to these regulations. So this is a good thing. We're going to be able to have this political fight. We've got Naomi Klein on our side and various other people who are providing evidence for us, of, you know, different ministers in the corrupt, scumbag, puppet government council, but nevertheless, ministers who are saying that the privatisation is legal, and it won't be legal until there's a democratically elected government of Iraq. So we have to sabotage these conferences, you know, because the decisions that are made about people's lives, about people's futures for generations to come in places like Iraq or Palestine or West Papua or Colombia or anywhere, these decisions are not made by men, women in uniform, in F-16s or Apaches or APCs. They're made by men in suits, in hotels, in conference centres, you know, deciding how to next exploit and loot and define what people will be capable of achieving in countries like Iraq. You know, people's futures have been clamped down and set for them. You know, their resources have been stolen from them. So we can go into these spaces and disrupt them and prevent these people from meeting, prevent these people from carrying out their agendas. So that's another thing we can do. The other thing we can do, and I mean, Quiva will talk about Palestine, but Palestine is inextricably linked to Iran. Those two occupations are, you know, the security of Israel does depend on the occupation in Iraq and America's success in Iraq. But one way that we can try and undermine the influence of Israel and its continual massacre and ethnic cleansing of Palestinian people is to, A, very simple, people can do this, don't shop in Marks and Spencer's, don't buy Israeli goods. You know, whenever there's a demonstration in Dublin or anywhere else for Palestinian freedom, join that demonstration, come out and be part of it. Come and look at film showings, meetings, try and find out a bit more about what's happening there. Cement Roadstone, I mean, Queen Butterly has been carrying out a vigil. She hasn't eaten for 10 days, 11 days now, the hunger strike in solidarity with Palestinian struggle. Cement Roadstone Holdings is an Irish company, and it has been instrumental in providing cement, basically, to the Israeli state to build the apartheid wall. And we will talk about this now, because this is...
Not now. Somebody else.
No, you have to! So anyway, there's a lot that we can do in solidarity and struggle with our brothers and sisters, basically. And I know it sounds a bit phony, but actually, it's true, you know. All of humanity are our brothers and sisters. Well, there is a lot we can do with Palestine, with Iraq. You know, try and keep abreast of what's going on, try and keep up with any kind of military movements or any kind of talk of troops, troop deployment, or, you know, troop movements, especially through Shannon. You being an island of really prime, you have a prime position, because there will be more troops and supplies and planes probably moving through Shannon. So try and get down there.